Live from Dearborn, this is the Locked Tomb Podcast. I'm Amy.
And I'm Mel.
Today we're taking a break from our Nona the Ninth reread to talk to someone really freaking cool.
We are talking to climate journalist and sword fighter Lissa Harris, who helped consult on everything to do with swords and sword fighting in Gideon the Ninth. And let me tell you, this is a really fun conversation.
Yeah, we learned so much. It was pretty wild. But before we get started, don't forget to check out the Locked Tomb Series Creator Hub on our website at locktombpod.com/fanmerch to support artists in the Locked Tomb fandom community.
And of course, if you'd like to support us here at the Locked Tomb Pod, you can find stickers, pens, and magnets on our website as well. And special for the holidays, you can order a personalized holiday card. Doesn't have to be for the holidays. Can be for any moment ever that you want to send a card to your pal from you and us here at the pod. We will include a personalized Locked Tomb joke just for your BFF. But without further ado, let's get to why we are all here, our conversation with Lissa Harris. We did it. Finally, we are here in the same virtual room. Thanks for agreeing to chat with us.
Yeah, no, thank you for staying on it because I get caught up in things and I'm like, oh man, all right. Yeah, that's how I want to do this, but we could absolutely have kicked that can down the road for a while. So
everyone is going to be so pumped to hear from you.
I'm just like, I mean, you guys are going to fully know the books in more exhaustive detail than I do. I'm like, oh man, I wanted to get through a second reread of all of them. I did not quite manage that.
No,
now
we're at
Gideon's three times. So hopefully I can, I realized too, I was like looking back on all this stuff. And when Taz and I first started corresponding about this, it was 2017.
Wow. Holy shit.
Holy shit. It's been a whole journey. It's been a whole several worlds since then. Books take a long time. And, you know, it's been so completely freaking delightful to watch this book go from like an idea that my friend had to something that I was frothing at the mouth with delight about and like trying to tell my friends that I was reading this book that was all full of sword lesbians in space. And they were like, okay, all right, nerd, whatever. And now it's, you know, it's a phenomenon. It's so good.
Totally.
It didn't have to be that good.
That is so cool.
Wow. Oh, it's been amazing. It's been amazing. I continue to be just delighted that I got to just touch the hem of this book with my grubby fingers. So it's great.
Well, I have so many follow-up questions already, but first, before we dive into it at the beginning of our show, I always tell really stupid jokes and try and make Amy laugh.
It's not hard.
I've prepared 4 jokes, actually. This is like major bonus.
Jesus.
Oh no.
So I'm gonna go through them and then we'll move into the actual event that everyone's actually here for. But first, my question for you is, what do you call a really long knife that gets thrown in the air?
Uh-oh. Oh no. This is a test.
A sword.
Oh God. No, I was preparing for dad joke level of, you know.
Oh yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. What does a wizard do with a sword? Sword surgery.
No.
Oh my God. Ouch.
Oh, I'm putting my hands over my mouth.
All right. And then this is my last one. I said I had 4. I'm going to skip one. What is a sword fighter's favorite food?
Sword d'oeuvres.
Oh, that's good. Although it's not a food. That's kind of like,
oh, that's true. That's a genre.
That's a
foods.
Genre. Their favorite food is sardines.
Oh man.
Gosh.
You know, I kept thinking I was going to figure one of these ahead. I've heard a lot of sword puns. I'm also, I'm in the newspaper world. All right. And I know a lot of bad puns, but no, I didn't know where we were going. Talking.
Thank you for playing along. Now we'll get to the very serious conversation that we are about to have. Amy, do you want to kick us off?
Sure. I do have some follow-ups. I was wondering, how even did this get started with Tamsin Muir? Did you guys know each other beforehand, or did she just type sword lesbian near me? Like, how did this get rolling?
I mean, I'm not near her at all, unfortunately. I'm in the Catskills of upstate New York, and
the dream.
She's in the UK. Very sad. But no, I was actually thinking about this and how I was going to answer this question. And I, you know, there was a time when I would have been really coy about it, but no, we fully met because we were both dumb fan fiction writers. And I don't want to denigrate that pastime, because the crop of folks that I, you know, somehow ended up running with has produced some spectacular novel debuts, like multiple ones. And damn, like, it was beautiful. It was beautiful to behold this crew of people just all kind of, you know, take to the sky at once and fly away.
Yeah. Fan fiction writers are so cool and talented.
But yeah. We were kind of Tumblr buddies, and she knew that I did sword stuff and, you know, wrote action stuff. And she asked me if I would read this. You know, she said she had about 30,000 words of sword fighting scenes, and would I have a look at it, and offered to pay me cash money to do so. And I was like, that's crazy. I would do this for free. This is astonishing. You're really good. You're fantastic. I will absolutely read your sword stuff. I'm delighted with this. And then, and she started sending me chunks of the manuscript, and I was just like, oh no, this is so good. But yeah, it's not something that I've done before in a professional way. I'm not a, you know, I'm an editor. I'm a newspaper person. I have definitely edited a lot of prose, but fiction is not really my world. So this was a new adventure for me.
Cool.
I was going to ask, would you call yourself a sword fighting choreography consultant?
Absolutely. No. No. And I actually, when she first asked me, I warned her. I was like, look, you know, I know some real sword master wizard type people. I know people who know what page of a 500-year-old manuscript a particular technique is on and discuss it with you all day long. And I'm going to tell you this right now. I will probably screw that stuff up, because I know a little bit about how sword stuff works and about what it feels like to be in a sword fight, and, you know, about like the dynamics of how action works. And I like to think I know a little bit about translating that into prose, into words, and also the emotions of it, because, you know, there's a lot about a fight scene that's not just about physical choreography. But what I am not is somebody with a whole bunch of letters after their name who's like an expert in swords or sword choreography or anything like that. And I can absolutely connect you with people who are. And if that's what you want, you should go find them. And she said, no, no, no. About doing a historical treatise on, you know, the techniques of Lichtenauer here. So I said, all right, fine, gulp. Just so we're all clear here, Gideon would kick my ass. It is known.
Oh, man.
I have read that Gideon is a little bit based on you. Was it strange to read the book and see yourself in Gideon?
It was so wonderful. It was so wonderful. No, let me back up here just a minute. Let me just clarify for the record here that I am a sixth house nerd. Like, that's a fact. That's a fact about me. It's probably a fact about a lot of sword people, frankly.
That's fascinating.
I'm not exactly Gideon, but I definitely see some things that definitely made me feel kind of smug, frankly, and very gratified. And when I actually met Taz, I didn't meet her until after we were done editing. And I think it was 2019, because it's kind of a burned into my brain is the year before the pandemic took off.
Yeah.
And the last big trip that I took in the world before everything completely came crashing down was I went to go visit her and to tromp around the UK for a bit that summer of 2019.
Wow.
Nice.
It was very magical. I had a magical time walking across a big chunk of the Cotswold Path, and that was great. But then I got to meet Taz, and I was like, yeah, we've been friends for like years now, and we've done this intense stuff together, and I've never met you, and it's amazing. We had this moment where, you know, we were just like sitting in her backyard, and she says something kind of about like there being some of my DNA in this character. And I was so delighted that I like literally rolled around in the grass. How dare you?
Oh my God. I love
it. You're so hot.
That.
I can't deal. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. I definitely, you know, I'm a little bit of a dirt bag, and I think sometimes people find that amusing. So definitely Gideon was the hero that I needed and never got in books growing up.
Yeah.
Where are all of the hot, secretly virtuous, dirtbag butch lesbians? Where are they? I needed a lot more of them in my reading diet than I ever got. And so when I finally met this book as a full-on adult, it's just like, where were you when I was, you know, like Molly Grew from The Last Unicorn. Where were you when I was young?
Totally.
How dare you come to me now?
I feel so similarly.
That's the gift that you and Tamsin Muir gave to the rest of us.
I mean, I got to touch it with my grubby fingers.
Yeah.
Damn. No, it's just astonishing.
Yeah, I actually would love to hear a little bit more about sword fighting in general as like a practice that you participate in. And like, are those spaces queer? Or I feel like it could go either way. And so I'm curious.
Well, there's a whole world of sword fighting to talk about here. And it is a really interesting world. I came to it, I think I wrote a little bit about this for Tor in the essay, but I came to it a little bit backwards from Gideon. I started out in sport fencing, studying foil in college, and kind of let that go for a while, and then picked it up again much later. And actually, after a pretty horrific leg break, I have a big metal plate in my right leg that it was a hell of a recovery. And when I finally managed to, you know, almost all the way recover, I took up fencing again because, I don't know, it just seemed like, all right, I've had this big lesson in how mortal my body is. And if I don't use it, I will lose it. So let's start fencing again. We miss that. I miss being good at it. And then discovered that there was a longsword teacher in my area and started doing that. So it was like, you know, longsword was never, it never felt natural to me. It was always like, oh, this is the weapon that I'm going to struggle with, right? One-handed weapon. Foil is not a rapier, but it's much more similar in terms of it's a thrusting weapon. It's a one-handed weapon. The longsword, there's a whole different set of body mechanics. And it was kind of an intense learning curve for me. Yeah. So, you know, when Gideon talks about how frustrating it is to have this weapon that he thinks is silly and ridiculous, that's also the realest thing, you know, sword fighters kind of slagging on each other's weapons. Like, oh, that weapon, this weapon's bullshit. Yeah. That's very real.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, I imagine it, you're using like a totally different muscles in your body. And if you've been fencing for years, I imagine the muscle memory of that is also just so stuck, and that it would
be
hard
to switch.
The muscle
memory is so much. It's so much. And it's really interesting what people practice and bring to it, you know, what they get good at other things, and then they bring into sword fighting, because people come at it from all different kinds of places. Sword fighting is a world that I think the main common denominator here is just that it's a world that's really full of nerds and like neurodivergent people in general. And like people come to that world with a whole, you know, range of different obsessions and different athletic capacities. And some people are just ferociously good athletes who are like, you know, into other martial arts. And some of them are huge history nerds. Some of them are huge weapons nerds. You know, people are there with a whole bunch of different backgrounds and reasons. For me, I felt like I've always been most at home within the world of HEMA, within the world of sword fighting, fighting people who also have a sport fencing background. There's certain kind of language. There's like a physical language that people who have done sport fencing can kind of speak to each other. I think that a lot of HEMAists are a little bit cranky about sport fencing because it's not martial. It's about as dangerous as badminton. You know, it's not really a fighting discipline. It's become extremely sportized, if that's a word. I'm not sure that it is. But you get so much more practice going full speed when you can really go hard against an opponent in a sport that's not as dangerous. It's actually difficult to go with full intensity, especially as a beginner in a discipline like longsword. You are wearing a ton of protective gear. The weapons that you are holding are very dangerous, even though they're not sharp. They're a significant mass, and you can badly injure someone. You could kill someone. It is something that people take seriously. And so it's hard to work up to the point where you are confident enough in your practice and your gear and your partner to really go hard. And with sport fencing, you know, people, at least this was my experience, I think you get a lot more practice in things like distance and timing and sizing up how far away your opponent is and things like that. So there were definitely, when I came into HEMA, I felt like there were things that I was struggling really mightily with that never have felt natural to me. And then there were other things that I felt like, because of my sport fencing background, okay, I have these skills and they'll translate. People work with the skills that they have and the advantages that they have.
Sounds so cool.
Yeah.
Are offhand weapons a thing in HEMA sword fighting?
They're a thing in rapier, and I don't know as much about rapier as I do about longsword. I've taken a few classes, but I haven't really studied rapier. But there is a whole literature of the use of offhand weapons in rapier. You can fight it either with just one weapon, or you can use an offhand. And so that part of it is absolutely a thing. And there are many different schools of rapier and different disciplines within it. So using a dagger to parry, even things like, you know, using a cloak, you can use a cloak as an offhand. The offhand weapons are very real. And, you know, I think there is an element of fantasy here. Clearly, you know, we don't have the knuckle knives. It's not a historical weapon.
No, but they're real cool.
They're so cool.
Serious three-bladed weapon. I love that. It's so dorky. I love it. It's so baroque. Yeah, that's not a thing. But you know, maybe it should be.
Yeah. Did you help when Tamsinmuir was coming up with the offhand weapons? Did you suggest any? Were there some that you were really pushing, or?
I think I obsessed more about the knuckle knives than about just about any other aspect of what we were collaborating on. You know, she kind of told me her concept for how like a knife gauntlet would work, how the knuckle knives would work. And I immediately went down a whole rabbit hole of, frankly, of hating my gear. It's like, oh no, this is a glove. And there is like nothing that a longsword fighter hates more than their gloves. They're always in the way. They're bulky. You need intense, intense gloves to fight longsword without breaking your fingers. And even sometimes people do break their fingers, even in the really good gloves. So there's all these logistical issues with gear. And the way that the gear is designed is like, you know, anything that's going to be more protective is going to cut down on your mobility and vice versa. And so immediately thinking about the knuckle knives, how would they work? How would they function in a fight? How could you actually use them? I don't know. I kind of fixated it on it a little bit. But, you know, my main worry about them at first was like, okay, so if you've got knives coming out of the back of your gauntlet here, and you try to parry with them in a way that the inside of your blade is making contact with your opponent, you're going to parry their blade right into your fingers.
Ooh, yeah.
This is a death wish. This is not good. Like right off the bat, you know, if you're going to use these in a defensive way, there's all kinds of problems to solve. Like maybe you could kind of parry with the outside of your blade, and in which case it really needs to be rigid. It needs a tang that goes down the back of your arm, because otherwise how are you going to be able to kind of maneuver that? And, you know, the more I kind of thought about this and what kind of cool things could we do with this defensively and how does it work? And it just sort of felt like, you know, this is too much. This is overthinking. You know, what this weapon is a last resort. This weapon is not for doing fancy third house flourishes and blade trapping moves and cool shit that you could, you know, put a fancy name on and stick in a sword treatise. This is when somebody messed up and you guys are too close to each other and you really just want to punch somebody in the face in a way that's going to end the fight. And that's kind of what I came to. Watching that scene unfold too, where they're choosing the knuckle knives.
Yeah.
That was very gratifying to me, seeing how that scene came out and just how they're all kind of talking about the knuckle knives as this sort of primitive choice. Mm-hmm. And then especially when, you know, when she fights Nibirius at Kanan House and the spectators are all just like, what is this?
I think totally. That would be my reaction too. Be like, what the hell?
Yeah. She doesn't have to deploy them in any kind of dramatic, gory way in order for people to be kind of quietly horrified that this is what's going on here. So watching that kind of take shape, that was very satisfying for me.
Yeah.
That is so cool. I know like literally nothing about weapons or swords or anything. And so I never even thought about the mechanics of the knuckle knives, but you're right.
Yeah, me neither.
I mean, it's so dangerous.
You really don't want to get a sword in between the knives and your actual knuckles, your actual fingers.
Right.
You don't want to parry somebody in a way that's going to cause you to lose four fingers at once. That would be bad.
Ooh,
totally.
Yeah.
I'm curious, like beyond the weapons themselves, like the choreography of the fighting. I read through what you put together for Tor, the essay that you wrote for Tor, and I think you talk a little bit about like, you can really tell when the writer doesn't know that much about sword fighting, right? Or like fight choreography as someone who is familiar with sword fighting. And so I'm curious, like what makes a scene really believable, whether it's like two people who are in a duel or whether there's like maybe it's more of like a battle scene, but what makes that believable, or how can writers make those scenes more believable?
I think that's a really deep question. There's actually, I don't know if they're still active. I'm not really on Tumblr these days, but like there was a Tumblr account called How to Fight Right with a WRITE that did a lot of kind of breaking down of action scenes and answering people's writing related fight questions and, you know, sometimes medical questions. It was fantastic stuff because it's like, how do you take this experience that you want to, you know, a fight scene is sort of exhilarating. You want it to be exhilarating. You want it to be exciting. You want it to be action-y. And how do you translate that into something that's quote unquote realistic? Mm-hmm. And also like, is that something you want? You don't want to take the reader out of it by being inaccurate. You don't want them to go, wait, that's totally ludicrous. Why would that happen?
Right.
But at the same time, you know, and Tamsin was pretty clear too from the beginning, like, you know, we do not want this to be like a 1,000-word sword treatise describing, you know, all of the perfect, like, here is the attack and here is the counter and here is how the counter is countered, and like, no, we're not going to do that.
Right.
And for me, I was kind of trying to live in that tension of like, okay, this isn't going to be perfect, and frankly some of it is going to be out there, and you know, Camilla doing a backflip, like, no. Would I take it out? Never. No, let her do the backflip.
Because it's still fantasy, you know?
Right.
It's
like, still fantasy, you know? Yeah. And you want it to have that feeling of authenticity without getting bogged down in the kind of the pedestrian nature of authenticity. You don't want to go down a rabbit hole of pursuing accuracy to the point where, okay, now we're going to like argue about, you know, the shape of the hilt and whether this attack of movement. You're just like, no,
right,
absolutely not. And I don't have, I'm not at that level of sword wizard knowledge. So like, that's beyond me anyway. So we're going to do this thing that's sort of a hybrid. We're going to try to keep it grounded in the world of action, but we're going to be thinking about the reader, and we're going to be thinking about how this scene moves along. And I just like, I'm sitting here blushing too, because this is not, you know, this was so much alchemy that happened in Tamsin's own mind that I had no access to, that like, I would just like blather on about some sword nonsense, blah, 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 blah. Send her these huge paragraphs of like, here's how I feel about how the way people stand and how your weight is supposed to go and blah, 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 blah. And then, you know, I would get back like this beautiful fight scene. And I'm like, how did you even do that? What did you take out of my brain what was it that I said that made sense, and then you turned it into this beautiful thing? Because this is alchemy. I don't know how you just did that, but you know, I did ramble on at her a lot.
Well, whatever you did worked, because those fight scenes are, I mean, she's also an incredible writer, but the fight scenes are so, I feel like Mel and I have talked about this before. Oftentimes yeah. in books, especially if the fight scene is very long, my eyes will glaze over a bit and I'll sort of speed through it. But in all of the Locke Tomb series, but especially Gideon, I was riveted. I read every single word of every fight scene and then would like go back and be like, wait, what? They, oh my God. And so, yeah, it was so well done. It was really, really cool.
Yeah,
it's so good. It's so good. And I have to say too, I did not do any pre-reading of Harrow or Nona. Mm-hmm. I got to read those books totally as a, you know, a reader, mm-hmm. like with a physical copy of the book. And it was very luxurious
yeah.
for me.
Yeah.
Like, oh, yeah. Man, I'm just reading this. And I wish I could remember an exact point, but I know there were several points at Harrow where I just like kind of looked at the book in my hand and was like, you wizard, how did you, I would have told you to say this thing. What did you know? How did you know this thing? I know that she's not a sword person, but there's sometimes is like a way that, you know, she'll be describing something martial going on. And I'm just like, how did you even know that?
Yeah. She's good.
Is that when I had, you know, three beers and was yelling about, you know, did you like absorb something out of my brain that I don't remember? You're just that good. She's just that good.
Do you have a favorite fight scene?
I totally do. I totally yes. do. Yeah. It is for sure the one where Gideon is first dueling her fellow cavaliers at yeah. Kanan House. And one of the reasons I really, really love that scene, and another thing I probably blathered on quite a bit about when we were doing edits, is the way that it really showcases a skill that is so important to any fighting discipline, but is kind of invisible to spectators, which is the skill of reading what's happening and reading in your opponent's body language where things are going to go and how they're going to fight. Mm-hmm. There's just a couple of moments in that scene where Gideon is kind of sizing up what's going to happen and knowing the future of what's going to happen. And it felt just very, very real to me mm-hmm. as somebody who, you know, you step into the ring and you're immediately sizing people up. And you're immediately seeing your own deficiencies or their deficiencies, or there's a kind of a sense of it being both like really holistic. Like, what does this person fight like? But also very specifically, like, what are they going to do right now?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And those elements were so present. It felt very authentic to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. We talk a lot about how Gideon has good intuition. And I feel like those fight scenes really demonstrate it super explicitly there. Mm-hmm. I think when Gideon's fighting Magnus first, I think the first line is like, in the first three seconds, Gideon knew that they were going to win. And then when Gideon's fighting Nibirius, the opposite is stated. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I remember reading when I realized she was going to lose to Nibirius, and I was so upset, not even having read the fight scene yet, because I'm very much like, I want the like golden, you know, that kind of like protagonist that's just naturally good at everything and never makes mm-hmm. a mistake ever. Sometimes I like those books. These are not those books. And I feel like that was like it was a good moment for me as a reader.
It was also correct. I think it was correct
totally.
that she lost to Nibirius. I think that was the right decision.
Yeah.
You know, to keep it from just being total, well, she wins everything. She's just yes. that good. No, we've got to like keep this in the realm of reality here.
Yeah.
Somebody who has not trained with this with this weapon and does not know the conventions of dueling and might be ferociously talented and might be incredibly good at sizing up an opponent, but is not going to have, she's not going to speak all of the vocabulary. They're going to be speaking to each other in this kind of sword vocabulary that she doesn't know all the words of. But I love also that even though she loses, she's like losing to win.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, she's like, all of a sudden she's reminding all of these kind of professional duelist types that this is a fight. And it's rude in that context that it's a fight. But this is actually something that sword fighting now, as opposed to sport fencing, but you know, that HEMA people, that longsword practitioners and other people who are studying HEMA for the martial aspect of it are constantly obsessing about. They're like, how martial is this discipline? How do we, a hot topic is like, how do we have a rule set that encourages people to fight as though this were actual violence without actually breaking each other?
Right.
It turns out that's a really difficult problem to solve.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And unlike sport fencing, you know, which there's also been a lot of rule evolution in sport fencing, but in HEMA, you can't even count on different events having the same rules. Every event has a different rule set, and people are always, you know, messing with the rule sets to try to get the outcome that they want, which is to encourage people to fight in particular ways.
Yeah.
And for a lot of people in HEMA, the goal is to make it more like a fight and less like a sport.
Right. That makes sense. It's also calling to mind in that same scene, I think it's Judith or Marta. I can't remember which. It must have been Marta. Someone's talking about how like Nibirius is good in how he's been trained, but he's not actually been in a real fight before. And then you have Gideon, who's like been fighting for her life basically since she was born. And so they're bringing very different ways of fighting into the space with each other. And that like obviously plays out.
Totally. Yeah. I also really love the scene where Gideon is going to fight the construct for the first time.
Oh yeah.
And it's just like, you know, basically like, yeah, it looks like sword, so I want to fight it. Yeah. I was kind of roasting her about it. She's like, really? Really? Swords? She's like, yup. Oh yeah.
That's one of my favorite Gideon moments. I was wondering, is there a fight that hasn't like a matchup that hasn't happened yet that you would love to see in the final book?
Oh man. Oh wow.
Hmm.
Oh, I really think about that. Oh.
I think about this all the time.
I was just thinking too how much I love watching Cam fight no matter who she's fighting. Like the Cam action in Nona is just like,
totally.
I know.
Yeah, so I'd love to see Paul in action. We'll see.
Yeah.
We'll see how that goes.
Yeah.
Man, that's a great question. I feel like we could, I feel like Pyrrha.
Oh my God. Yeah. We've never seen Pyrrha really fight.
We haven't really, we've seen lots of competence.
Yeah.
From Pyrrha, but not a whole lot of physical combat. And yeah. Oh, I would almost be excited to see her fight, you know, fight someone she really loves. Like,
yeah.
What would a Pyrrha Electo fight look like?
I don't know.
It would be epic and heartbreaking.
It would be epic. I have no special access to what's going on in Electo. I'm just spitballing here.
I think I want to see, I'm curious about Coronabeth, because we know that Coronabeth has some sort of skill. And we almost,
she trains, right?
But we don't, you know? So I'm like, I kind of want to see what's, you know, does Corona really got it? I'm curious about that. And I definitely am curious about Paul too. Like, what is Paul's fighting style going to be, knowing that Camilla is so epic and that Palamedes probably has the intellectual, like, you know, he probably knows about swords because he reads about them.
He read about them in a book.
So what is...
Yeah, this moment, I just... I'm so glad I did reread Gideon, because I picked up on this and I'd forgotten about it the first time I read it. And I just laughed at it all over again when Palamedes is like, well, you know how if you learn a sword technique, but you didn't read about it in a book, yeah. You really know it. And all the sword fighters just look at him like, what?
Yeah.
Oh, nerd. No.
Yeah, that was not Palamedes' best moment.
That was so funny.
There are absolutely people like that in HEMA, but, you know, there are also quite a lot of people who were like, no.
Yeah.
No, I don't know. Is he gonna help the action along in the next book? We're gonna find out.
Yeah.
I'm still mourning our former arrangement of personalities to totally. Some extent.
I know.
But I want to get to know Paul.
Yeah.
I don't know Paul yet.
Yeah. I think they'll probably be fantastic.
They're gonna be magnificent.
Because
I'm sure.
Tanzimir is incredible, right. But
they're a mashup of two of my favorite characters.
Totally. But I don't know if you'll have the answer to this, but in Harrow the Ninth, there are so many pommel jokes that are made. And it's like, it's basically like Harrow never remembering what to call the pommel, and Gideon as the second person narrator, like always cracking a joke about it. Is that an inside joke, or is that like did you have anything to do with that?
I got to read Harrow just like everybody else. I read it in book form. I was so delighted to be able to do that. And it partly just because I got to have the experience of hollering about it with other people instead of just having all of the private feelings. Yeah. So many private feelings about Gideon that, you know, I could only sort of holler incoherently about. I'm like, you have to read this book, but it's not out in the world yet, so you can't. Ooh, having that all world in me was like, you know, I wanted company.
Yeah.
But yeah, so Harrow, you know, I cannot claim any kind of responsibility for the pommel jokes, but I do, you know, I do feel slightly roasted, because I think I took a great many turgid paragraphs and text edits worth of, you know, doing things like lecturing Taz on not calling a longsword a broadsword. And, you know, like, no, a broadsword is a Scottish basket-hilted sword. It doesn't look anything like a Shut it, Harris. My God. Yes. So.
Wow.
I think I did a lot of, you know, of gentle, blunt, whatever, any kind of just correcting of little terminology. And no, this is called that. Mm-hmm. And this is called that. And this thing goes there. And so, you know, maybe that's a bit of a roast. Yeah. Maybe not.
It's so funny. I was also wondering, because I've thought about this, there's this sort of thing that happens sometimes in sci-fi where we get a little bit of this like Baroque fantasy twist, like Star Wars with lightsabers and these books with swords. Do you have any idea, and if you actually know the reason why, you don't have to say it, but do you have any like theories on why they're using swords when obviously like the technology would make it seem like there are many more like obvious choices?
Really, they could have had guns.
Yeah.
I mean, there's, you know, this is a question that gets into that kind of classic, like, is this a Watsonian question or is it a Doylist question? Right? Are we talking about what is the reason that the author made this choice, or are we talking about the in-universe reason why?
Mm.
And I think, you know, at some level, it's the fiction writer and lover in me wants to say, look, if you want to write swords into your book, you will figure it out, right? Cool. That's why.
Yeah.
You know, but that's a Doylist reason. Uh-huh. It's not a Watsonian.
I like it though. I mean, honestly, well, swords are cool is enough for me.
Yeah. I think about too, like in the ancillary justice books, there's a gun, and the gun has, which I love those books real bad.
Same. Yeah.
The gun has a very particular function, and you know, it is rare. It's a rare commodity in the universe. It's not like, It's not like this country, which is like the Wild Wild West. Everyone has a gun, right?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
It's a constraint, right? It's a constraint on your universe that can make things seem terribly exciting when that constraint is broken.
Mm-hmm.
So when a gun does show up, it's like, oh boy, we're in for it now.
Right.
It's a gun. And yeah, this is something that I've kicked around. If I ever do end up writing any sort of a sci-fi tome of my own, I'm like, what am I going to do about this? Because I do want there to be fighting, but if without kind of constraints on that fighting that make the fighting personal and up close and kind of, you know, melee fighting versus ranged fighting you know, at least something that makes it more intensely one-on-one, a little more dramatic. It's a different calculation. It's a different kind of warfare.
Yeah.
I guess.
For sure.
Absolutely.
I'm curious. So we know that you are a journalist. What do you write about?
This is a question also that I'm going to turn around and go, like, how spoilery can we get here?
Oh.
With regard to Nona in particular.
Oh, very
spoiled.
Yeah,
everyone has read everything,
yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, so this was actually not the case when I first started working on this stuff. It's more of a generalist. But right now I'm reporting on climate change and mm-hmm. climate policy. So
yeah. So Nona was very pertinent.
Nona was so pertinent that I really felt like it got so personal. I was just like, this is so rude. How dare you? You know, you had me at Sword Lesbian Necromancers in Space. Mm-hmm. Like, I thought this was going to be a fun, gory romp.
Yeah.
This is us now. This is us. Mm-hmm. This is the world.
Right.
And Nona especially, you have so many flashbacks to a world that is very plausibly not too far
mm-hmm.
from what we're doing here now.
Right.
I mean, you can see the personality clashes unfolding. You can see the increasingly desperate attempts to solve problems and then just run away from them. You can see that unfolding in a way that feels very current
mm-hmm.
and very plausible and frankly very bound up with the stuff that I'm trying to stay cheerful about and delve into deeply at the same time here. So
yeah. Wow, that is
so yeah, Nona was a whole experience. Reading Nona as a climate policy reporter was a lot.
Yeah.
And you know, in a good way. And I am rooting for vengeance here because
yeah.
But at the same time, you know, one of the things that's really wonderful to me about Nona is how it both kind of made John this incredible villain
mm-hmm.
and also made him deeply relatable.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
It's like, oh, I get it. Oh, of course you hate Blood of Eden. Oh, hate them forever.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's very like nuanced. There's something that I think about a lot whenever we, you know, when we get into the John chapters is how there's a lot of powerful people just continually fucking it up for everyone else, even when, you know, at one point Jod was a well-meaning dude and then it took a turn. and also it is relatable because it was a dire situation, right? Mm-hmm. And like, I read it as a cautionary tale, not that Earth is going to unleash necromancy on one guy maybe in our world, but who knows? Who knows?
But you know, could we see like an Elon Musk type marshaling the resources of the world and fleeing and you know,
yeah, no doubt,
I could see it.
Absolutely,
it felt very real and very personal.
Wow,
of course it's not, but yeah, it just does. It brought it all home.
I have one two-parter last question from me, which is around, as a writer and someone who is involved in sword fighting, as like a young queer person who might be looking to get into journalism and or sword fighting, what would you recommend? Like, where do people go?
Well, first of all, I guess just, you know, a generic bit of advice from a 40-something who's been around both of these worlds for a minute. Sword fighting is very dangerous and swords are pointy and all, but it's not as dangerous as journalism. Look out for yourself.
Yeah.
Do not let your babies become news reporters. It's bad for your health. I don't know if you noticed, it's real bad out there. Every once in a while, get tapped to talk to college kids. And increasingly, I feel like I do my best to just, you know, if you can do anything else, you might want to. You want to look into that. I get that this is fun, and it is. And it's also very necessary.
Totally.
You know, it's important to the fabric of our society and all that, but it's no way to live. I'm laughing. I'm out on my own again. I'm a freelancer again. Mm. I've been off and on freelancing most of my career. I've had some amazing jobs, but, you know, it's not a world where you can ever rest easy in a job.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's a lot about freelancing that works for me, but it really is a brutal industry. So I would say if you're going to go into journalism, you know, protect your physical well-being, protect your heart, protect your psyche, because it is truly a field that does not love you back. Mm. It's very tough.
Yeah.
And for sword fighting specifically, wow, I got going on some other tangent, didn't even get talking about queerness and sword fighting. It's a whole topic. It's a rich topic. There are a lot of queer people in sword world. There are a lot of trans people in sword world. And they're some of the most amazing people that I've ever met. There's a whole community there, but it is also like, I will absolutely not be coy about this. Like, this is a world that's fairly dominated by cis white dudes and, you know, people who are either really, really deep in history or really, really good at winning tournaments kind of set the tone for the rest of us. Mm. And it's tough. There are a lot of kind of culture things that are playing out within HEMA. There are a lot of contests and struggles that on a social level, which is just, you know, it's what happens when you get a ton of gigantic nerds that are really passionate about a particular thing and they go make their own rules, make their own society. Topics like, how do you run women's tournaments and how do you set the rules for that and trans inclusion in women's tournaments? Mm. This stuff does not need to be ferociously debated, but it is in the community. And, you know, how do you be welcoming to people who, you know, might find it intimidating to step into a class? People have different attitudes about that, how to approach it, different instructor philosophies. And it's difficult.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I would say find a club, you know, if you can find a club that's really interested in talking about this stuff in a good way and not kind of going down rabbit holes, you know, that's really kind of where it's at. But it's really tough. Like I haven't been involved in sword fighting that much over the past couple of years because so much of it had kind of scaled back with the pandemic. Mm-hmm. My teacher isn't teaching anymore. Mm. You know, I go down to the city every once in a while, and the city meaning New York. There's a club in New York, but they lost their physical space during the pandemic. They're smaller than they were, and not as together. Mm-hmm. So the pandemic has really done a number on a lot of clubs. It's such a small discipline. There's not a whole lot of clubs to choose from. It's not like within one area you can kind of usually pick and choose.
Right.
So it's tough. It's a niche thing. Yeah.
Well, until then, we've got our books to read about sword fighting if we can't find the space for it. And if you all heard that, we need to make our own community. Yeah,
solo training is a thing. You can get a weapon or a trainer, you know, like it doesn't even have to be like a metal sword. Those are expensive. They're very spendy.
Yeah.
If you can watch videos, you can swing it around in your yard, or if you're lucky enough to have high ceilings in your living room, there's a lot that you can do. But yeah, fighting with real opponents there's nothing like it. So if you do have a good club in your area, muster up your courage and walk through the door, and they'll probably be delighted to see you because you always need new blood.
Yeah. Mel, I'll go if you go.
I'm in. Yeah. I'm looking for things to for new hobbies. We'll say that.
We can do a video episode of us learning to fight each other.
Yeah, I'm sure everyone would just love to, love to watch that one.
Well, if you ever want to fight and you're in upstate New York, come and see me. And
yeah, that
would be so careful what you wish for. Yeah. I'll get up there.
I'm really out of shape. So, you know, like I said, I haven't been training too much. So, you know, if you're going to destroy me, now's your chance.
I don't know if I'm strong enough to lift a two-handed sword.
Oh, you are. Oh, you're absolutely strong enough to lift it. Are you strong enough to keep it extended for long periods of time and keep doing stuff with it? They're not that heavy. They're a couple pounds.
Huh.
But
I think the answer is
you've got your arms extended and you're like, you know, you're tired, you're gassed, you're wearing way too much gear and your opponent has been, you know, mercilessly attacking you over and over again and you're just like, oh man, this thing's getting heavy all the time. Try taking a 2-pound weight, just holding it out like this. See how long.
Oh, yeah. I did take a Pilates class once, and I was very challenged by that. And it's a lot of holding out little weights. So I probably have to work up to the sword. To the sword.
Yeah, I would I would say, you know, weightlifting and general endurance is a good practice if you're looking into getting into sword fighting.
Yeah, I can do that. I will. That's where I will begin.
Excellent.
This was so interesting.
Yeah. Really cool. Really cool. Well, thank you so much. It has been such a pleasure. I feel like I learned so much just in this hour-long conversation that I did not know I was going to learn. So
you're very flattering, and I already have a tremendous ego, and you're not helping. Thanks a lot. Now I'm even more smug. Thank you. Oh, you know what? You know what I do want to tell you?
Yeah.
I do want to tell you where you can find me.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So if people want my stuff, and bear in mind it's not going to be as much, you know, swords and lesbians content, although, you know, I don't know, maybe I'll find a way to work some of that in, but I have a Substack newsletter that I actually just launched a few weeks ago.
Oh, cool.
And it is called Empire of Dirt, and it's about climate change and upstate New York problems.
Nice.
Cool.
So you can find me on empireofdirt.substack.com.
Okay.
And also on Twitter, where I am too much, which is how you guys found me. So, you know, I'm also Lissa Harris on Twitter, but who knows for how long, because Twitter is a wasteland. So
it's a hellscape for sure.
It's a hellscape. And I'll probably be the last monkey left in that zoo.
So. I'll be there right alongside you.
I will be far away.
Yeah, Amy doesn't do social media.
I'll be busy editing.
That's wise. That is wise.
Yeah.
It's bad for your health, just like journalism. And sword fighting. And necromancy, probably.
Sounds pretty bad.
Well, thank you so much, Lissa.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
This was fun.
Again, really fun. I'm really glad we actually got to do this. We nailed down a date. We all did it. We were all available.
Yes.
It's like a magic situation. So.
Y'all are very professional. Thank you. I kept us all on task. Thank you.
Just wait until we show up and beg you to teach us how to fight with swords.
Yeah.
Oh, I got a lot of swords around here. It's, you know, maybe we'll cross swords one day.
Yeah.
Yes, we'll make it happen. Yeah. I got to go lift some weights first.
Yeah.
You got to lift a lot of weights first. Do you even lift, bro? Yeah, I went back to the gym recently for the first time since before pandemic and started lifting again.
Yeah.
And actually Tamsin emailed me, I want to say like a few weeks ago after I hadn't heard from her for a long time. And I was so delighted. I wrote her back. I was just like, I'm sorry, but this is very on brand, but you've caught me doing like overhead barbell presses. So I'm going to write you back a big email in a moment, but I'm just going to gloat about that for a minute. It's like, stop. Why are you like this? Epic. No.
So epic. You are, Gideon.
Oh my God.
So, but yeah, but you know, but sixth house, nerd, yeah. Huge nerd. But I do lift. There's that.
But you lift, bro.
I will skip leg day. That's it. That's another difference. Gideon does not celebrate leg day, but I'm out here doing squats, man.
The differences. They're nuanced, but they're there.
How are you going to lunge if you don't do your squats? Come on.
Oh, man. All right, y'all.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. Really
appreciate
it.
Thank you so much. This was so fun. And we will hit you up at some point and we will.
Yeah, you're not that far away from me.
No, very close. All right. Bye, y'all.
Thank you so much for joining us for that really fun conversation with Lissa. We learned so much. If you have questions or comments, send us a question on our website, locktombpod.com, or on Twitter at locktombpod. If you liked this podcast, tell your friends to listen or rate and review us. Your support means so much to us, and we can't thank you enough. Thanks always to Olivia Kay for our theme music. I'm Amy.
And I'm Mel.
And we'll see you next time here at the Locked Tomb Podcast.